capitalists I know have all become capitalists with regard to cash money. But, thanks to your people, those I contacted have no further need of money, do they? The Russian asked rhetorically. You greedy bastard, Clark observed, with half a smile. The race started on time. The fans cheered the marathon runners as they took their first lap around the stadium, then disappeared out the tunnel onto the streets of Sydney, to return in 2.5 hours or so. In the meantime, their progress would be followed on the Jumbotron for those who sat in the stadium seats, or on the numerous televisions that hung in the ramp and concourse areas. Trucks with remote TV transmitters rolled in front of the lead runners, and the Kenyan, Jomo Nyerere, held the lead, closely followed by Edward Fulmer, the American, and Willem Terhoust, the Dutchman, the leading trio not 2 steps apart, and a good 10 meters ahead of the next group of runners as they passed the first milepost. Like most people, Will Gehring saw this on his hotel room TV as he packed. He'd be renting diving gear tomorrow, the former Army colonel told himself, and he'd treat himself to the best diving area in the world, in the knowledge that the oceanic pollution that was harming that most lovely of environments would soon be ending. He got all of his clothing organized in a pair of Tumi-wheeled suitcases and set them by the door of the room. He'd be diving while all the ignorant plague victims flew off to their homes across the world, not knowing what they had and what they'd be spreading. He wondered how many would be lost to phase one of the project. Computer projections predicted anywhere from 6 to 30 million, but Gehring thought those numbers conservative. The higher the better, obviously, because the A vaccine had to be something that people all over the globe would cry out for, thus hastening their own deaths. The real cleverness of it was that if medical tests on the vaccine recipients showed Shiva antibodies, they'd be explained away by the vaccine. A was a live virus vaccine, as everyone would know, just a little more live than anyone would realize until it was a little too late. It was 10 hours later in New York, and there in the safe house, Clark, Popoff, Sullivan, and Chatham sat, watching network coverage of the Olympic Games, like millions of other Americans. There was nothing else for them to do. It was boring for them all, as none were marathoners, and the steps of the leading runners were endlessly the same. "The heat must be terrible to run in," Sullivan observed. "It's not fun," Clark agreed. "Ever run in a race like this?" "No," John shook his head. "But I've had to run away from things in my time, mainly Vietnam. It was pretty hot there, too." "You were there?" Popoff asked. "A year and a half's worth, 3rd SOG, Special Operations Group."
"Doing what?"
"Mainly looking and reporting. Some real operations, raids, assassinations, that sort of thing. Taking out people we really didn't like." 30 years ago, John thought. 30 years. He'd given his youth to one conflict, and his manhood to another. And now, in his approaching golden years, what would he be doing? Was it really possible, what Popoff had told him? It seemed so unreal. But the Ebola scare had been real as hell. He remembered flying all over the world about that one, and he remembered the news coverage that had shaken his country to its very foundations. And he remembered the terrible revenge that America had taken as a result. Most of all, he remembered lying with Ding Chavez on the flat roof of a Tehran dwelling and guiding 2 smart bombs in to take the life of the man responsible for it all, in the first application of the president's new doctrine. But if this were real, if this project that Popoff had told them about were what he said it was, then what would his country do? Was it a matter for law enforcement or something else? Would you put people like this on trial? If not, then what? Laws hadn't been written for crimes of this magnitude. And the trial would be a horrid circus, spreading news that would shake the foundations of the entire world. That one corporation could have the power to do such a thing as this. Clark had to admit to himself that his mind hadn't expanded enough to enclose the entire thought. He'd acted upon it, but not really accepted it. It was too big a concept for that. "Dimitri, why did you say they are doing this?"
"John Clark, they are druids. They are people who worship nature as though it were a god. They say that the animals belong in places, but people do not. They say they want to restore nature. And to do that, they are willing to kill all of mankind. This is madness, I know, but it is what they told me. In my room in Kansas, they have videotapes and magazines that proclaim these beliefs. I never knew such people existed. They say that nature hates us, that the planet hates us for what we, all men, have done. But the planet has no mind, and nature has no voice with which to speak. Yet they believe that they do have these things. It's amazing," the Russian concluded. "It is as if I have found a new, mad religious movement whose God requires our deaths, human sacrifice, whatever you wish to call it." He waved his hands in frustration at his inability to understand it.
"Do we know what this guy Gearing looks like?" Noonan asked.
"No," Chavez said. "Nobody told me. I suppose Colonel Wilkerson knows, but I didn't want to ask him."
"Christ ding, is this whole thing possible?" the FBI agent asked next.
"I guess we'll know in a few hours, man. I know something like this happened once before, and I know John and I helped take out the bastard who did it to us. On the technical side, I'd have to ask Patsy about it. I don't know biology. She does."
"Jesus," Noonan concluded, looking over at the entrance to the pump room. The three of them headed over to a concession area and got half-liter cups of Coca-Cola, then sat down to watch the blue-painted door. People walked past it, but nobody actually approached it.
"Tim?"
"Yeah, Ding."
"Do you have arrest powers for this?"
The FBI agent nodded.
"I think so. Conspiracy to commit murder. The crime originated in America, and the subject is an American citizen, so, yes, that should hold up. I can take it a step further. If we kidnap his ass and bring him to America, the courts don't care how somebody got there. Once he's in front of a United States District Court judge, how he came to be there doesn't interest the court at all."
"How the hell do we get him out of the country?" Chavez wondered next. He activated his cell phone.
Clark picked up the Stu-4's receiver. It took 5 seconds for Ding's encryption system to handshake with his. A computerized voice finally said, "Line is secure," followed by 2 beeps.
"Yeah?"
"John, it's Ding. I got a question."
"Shoot."
"If we bag this Gearing guy, then what? How the hell do we get him back to America?"
"Good question. Let me work on that."
"Right."
And the line went dead.
The logical place to call was Langley, but as it turned out, the DCI was not in his office. The call was routed to his home.
"John, what the hell is going on down there anyway?" Ed Foley asked from his bed.
Clark told the DCI what he knew. That took about 5 minutes. "I have Ding staking out the only place this can be done, and—"
"Jesus Christ, John, is this for real?" Ed Foley asked, somewhat breathlessly.
"We'll know if this Gearing guy shows up with a package containing the bug, I suppose," Clark replied. "If he does, how do we get Ding, his people, and this Gearing guy back to the States?"
"Let me work on that."
"What's your number?"
John gave it to him, and Ed Foley wrote it down on a pad.
How long have you known about this?
Less than 2 hours. The Russian guy is right here with me. We're in an FBI safe house in New York City.
Is Carol Breitling implicated in this?
I'm not sure. Her ex-husband sure as hell is, Clark answered. Foley closed his eyes and thought.
You know, she called me about you guys a while back. Asked a couple of questions. She's the one who shook the new radios loose from E-Systems. She talked to me as though she was briefed in on Rainbow.
She's not on my list, Ed, John pointed out.
He'd personally approved all of the people cleared into the Rainbow compartment.
Yeah, I'll look at that, too. Okay, let me check around and get back to you.
Right. Clark replaced the receiver.
We have an FBI guy with the Sydney team, he told the others.
Who?
Sullivan asked.
Tim Noonan. Know him?
Used to be tech support with HRT.
Clark nodded.
That's the guy.
I've heard about him. Supposed to be pretty smart.
He is. He saved our ass in Hereford. Probably my wife and daughter, too.
So he can arrest this Gearing mutt nice and legal.
You know, I've never worried all that much about enforcing the law. Mainly, I enforce policy, but not law.
I suppose things are a little different with the agency, eh? Sullivan asked with a smile.
The James Bond factor never really goes away, even with people who are supposed to know better.
Yeah, some.
Gearing left his hotel, carrying a backpack like many of the other people on the street, and flagged a cab just outside. The marathon was about half an hour from its conclusion. He found himself looking around at the crowded sidewalks and all the people on them. The Australians seemed a friendly people, and what he'd seen of their country was pleasant enough. He wondered about the Aborigines and what might happen to them, and the bushmen of the Kalahari Desert, and other such tribal groupings around the world, so removed from normal life that they wouldn't be exposed to Shiva in any way. If fate smiled upon them, well, he decided, that was okay with him. These kinds of people didn't harm nature in any way, and they were insufficiently numerous to do harm even if they wanted to, which they didn't, worshipping the trees and the thunder as the project members did. Were there enough of them to be a problem? Probably not. The bushmen might spread out, but their folkways wouldn't allow them to change their tribal character very much, and though they'd increase somewhat in number, they'd probably not even do much of that. The same with the Abos of Australia. There hadn't been many of them before the Europeans had arrived, after all, and they'd had millennia to sweep over the continent. So the project would spare many people, wouldn't it? It was vaguely comforting to the retired colonel that Shiva would kill only those whose lifestyles made them the enemies of nature. That this criterion included everyone he could see out the cab windows troubled him little.
The taxi stopped at the regular drop-off point to the stadium. He paid his fare plus a generous tip, got out, walked toward the massive concrete bowl. At the entrance, he showed his security pass and was waved through. There came the expected creepy feeling. He'd be testing his B vaccine in a very immediate way, first admitting the Shiva virus into the fogging system, and then walking through it, breathing in the same nanocapsules as all the other 100,000-plus tourists. And if the B-shot didn't work, he'd be condemning himself to a gruesome death. But he'd been briefed in on that issue a long time ago.
"That Dutchman looks pretty tough," Noonan said. Willem Terhoust was currently in the lead, and had picked up the pace, heading for a record despite the weather conditions. The heat had taken its toll of many runners. A lot of them slowed their pace to get cold drinks, and some ran through pre-spotted water showers to cool off, though the TV commentators said that these had the effect of tightening up the leg muscles and were therefore not really a good thing for marathoners to do. But they took the relief anyway, most of them, or grabbed the offered ice water drinks and poured them over their faces. "Self-abuse," Chavez said, checking his watch and reaching for his radio microphone. "Command to Tomlinson."
"I'm here, boss,"
Chavez heard in his earpiece.
"Coming in to relieve you."
"Roger that. Fine with us, boss," the sergeant replied from inside the locked room.
"Come on."
Ding stood, waving for Pierce and Noonan to follow. It was just 100 feet to the blue door. Ding twisted the knob and went inside. Tomlinson and Johnston had hidden in the shadows in the corner opposite the door. They came out when they recognized their fellow team members.
"Okay, stay close and stay alert," Chavez told the two sergeants.
"Rojo," Homer Johnston said on his way out. He was thirsty and planned to get himself something to drink. And on the way out he placed his hands over his ears, popping them open to rid himself of the pump noise. The sound was annoying, Chavez realized in the first few minutes. Not overly loud, but constant. A powerful, deep whirring. Like a well-insulated automobile engine. It hovered at the edge of your consciousness and didn't go away. And on further reflection made him think of a beehive. Maybe that was the annoying part of it.
"Why are we leaving the lights on?" Noonan asked.
"Good question." Chavez walked over and flipped the switch. The room went almost totally dark, with just a crack of light coming in from under the steel fire door. Chavez felt his way to the opposite wall, managed to get there without bumping his head, and leaned against the concrete wall, allowing his eyes to adjust to the darkness. Gearing was dressed in shorts and low-cut hiking boots, with short socks as well. It seemed the form of dress the locals had adopted for dealing with the heat. And it was comfortable enough, as was his backpack and floppy hat. The stadium concourses were crowded with fans coming in early for the closing ceremonies, and he saw that many of them were standing in the fog to relieve themselves from the oppressive heat of the day. The local weather forecasters had explained ad nauseam about how this version of the El Niño phenomenon had affected the global climate and inflicted unseasonably hot weather on their country, for which they all felt the need to apologize. He found it all rather amusing. Apologize for a natural phenomenon? How ridiculous. With that thought, he headed to his objective. In doing so, he walked right past Homer Johnston, who was standing, sipping his Coke. "Any other places the guy might use?" Chavez worried suddenly in the darkness.
"No," Noonan replied. "I checked the panel on the way in. The whole stadium fogging system comes from this one room. If it's going to happen, it will happen here."
"If it's gonna happen," Chavez said back, actually hoping that it would not. "If that happened, they'd go back to Lieutenant Colonel Wilkerson and find out where this Gearing guy was staying, and then pay a call on him and have a friendly little chat." Gearing spotted the blue door and looked around for security people. The Aussie SAS troops were easily spotted, once you knew how they dressed. But though he saw two Sydney policemen walking down the concourse, there were no army personnel. Gearing paused 50 feet or so from the door. The usual mission jitters, he told himself. He was about to do something from which there was no turning back. He asked himself for the 1,000th time if he really wanted to do this. There were fellow human beings all around him, people seemingly just like himself, with hopes and dreams and aspirations. But no, those things they held in their minds weren't like the things he held in his own, were they? They didn't get it, didn't understand what was important and what was not. They didn't see nature for what she was.
and as a result they lived lives that were aimed only at hurting or even destroying her. Driving cars that injected hydrocarbons into the atmosphere, using chemicals that found their way into the water, pesticides that killed birds or kept them from reproducing, aiming spray cans at their hair, whose propellants destroyed the ozone layer. They were killing nature with nearly every act they took. They didn't care. They didn't even try to understand the consequences of what they were doing. And so, no, they didn't have a right to live. It was his job to protect nature, to remove the blight upon the planet, to restore and save. And that was a job he must do. With that decided, Will Gearing resumed his walk to the blue door, fished in his pocket for the key, and inserted it into the knob.
"Command, this is Johnston. You got company coming in. White guy, khaki shorts, red polo shirt, and backpack," Homer announced loudly into everyone's ear. Beside him, Sergeant Tomlinson started walking in that direction, too.
"Heads up," Chavez said in the darkness. There were two shadows in the crack of light under the door, and then the sound of a key in the lock. And then there was another crack of light, a vertical one as the door opened, and a silhouette, a human shape. And, just that fast, Chavez knew that it was all real after all. Would the lights reveal an inhuman monster, something from another planet, or just a man, he saw, as the lights flipped on? About 50, with closely cropped salt-and-pepper hair. A man who knew what he was about. He reached for the wrench hanging on the wall-mounted pegboard, then shrugged out of his backpack, and loosened the two straps that held the flap in place.
It seemed to Chavez that he was watching a movie, something separated from reality, as the man flipped off the motor switch, ending the whirring. Then he closed the valve and lifted the wrench to...
"Hold it right there, pal," Chavez said, emerging from the shadows. "Who are you?" the man asked in surprise. Then his face told the tale. He was doing something he shouldn't. He knew it. And suddenly someone else did, too.
"I could ask you the same thing, except I know who you are. Your name is Will Gearing. What are you planning to do, Mr. Gearing?"
"I'm just here to swap out the chlorine canister on the fogging system," Gearing replied, shaken all the more that this Latino seemed to know his name. How had that happened? Was he part of the project? And if not, then what? It was as if someone had punched him in the stomach, and now his entire body cringed from the blow. "Oh, let's see about that, Mr. Gearing. Tim?" Chavez gestured for Noonan to get the backpack. Sergeant Pierce stayed back, his hand on his pistol and his eyes locked on their visitor.
"Sure looks like a normal one," Noonan said. If this was a counterfeit, it was a beaut. He was tempted to open the screw top, but he had good reason not to.
Next to the pump motor, Chavez took the wrench and removed the existing canister.
"Looks about half full to me, pal. Not time to replace it yet, at least not with something called Shiva.
Tim, let's be careful with that one."
"You bet."
Noonan tucked it back into Gearing's pack and strapped the cover down. "We'll have this checked out. Mr. Gearing, you are under arrest," the FBI agent told him. "You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to have an attorney present during questioning. If you cannot afford an attorney, we will provide you with one. Anything you say can be used against you in a court of law. Do you understand these rights, sir?" Gearing was shaking now, and turned to look at the door, wondering if he could. He couldn't. Tomlinson and Johnston chose that moment to come in.
"Got him?"
Homer asked.
"Yep," Ding replied. He pulled his cell phone out and called America. Again, the encryption systems went through the synchronization process.
"We got him," Chavez told Rainbow Six. "And we got the canister thing, whatever you call it. How the hell do we get everybody home?"
There's an Air Force C-17 at Alice Springs, if you can get there. It'll wait for you.
Okay, I'll see if we can fly there.
Later, John.
Chavez thumbed the end button and turned to his prisoner.
Okay, pal, you're coming with us.
If you try anything stupid, Sergeant Pierce here will shoot you right in the head.
Right, Mike?
Yes, sir. I sure as hell will, Pierce responded in a voice from the grave.
Noonan reopened the valve and turned the pump motor back on. Then they went back out into the stadium concourse and walked to the cab stand. They ended up needing two taxis, both of which headed to the airport. There they had to wait an hour and a half for a 737 for the desert airport, a flight of nearly 2 hours.
Alice Springs is in the very center of the continental island called Australia, near the McDonnell Mountain Range, and a strange place indeed to find the highest of high-tech equipment. But here were the huge antenna dishes that downloaded information from America's reconnaissance, electronic intelligence, and military communication satellites. The facility there is operated by the National Security Agency, NSA, whose main site is at Fort Meade, Maryland, between Baltimore and Washington. The Qantas flight was largely empty, and on arrival, an airport van took them to the U.S. Air Force terminal, which was surprisingly comfortable, though here the temperature was blisteringly hot, heading down from an afternoon temperature of 120.
"You're Chavez?" the sergeant in the distinguished visitors area asked.
"That's right. When's the plane leave?"
"They're waiting for you now, sir. Come this way."
And with that, they entered another van, which rolled them right to the front left side door, where a sergeant in a flight suit gestured them aboard.
"Where are we going, Sarge?" Chavez asked on his way past.
"Hickam in Hawaii first, sir, then on to Travis in California."
"Fair enough. Tell the driver he can leave."
"Yes, sir."
The crew chief laughed as he closed the door and walked forward. It was a mobile cavern, this monster transport aircraft, and there seemed to be no other passengers aboard. Gearing hadn't been handcuffed, somewhat to Ding's disappointment, and he behaved docilely, with Noonan at his side.
"So you want to talk to us about it, Mr. Gearing?" the FBI agent asked.
"What's in it for me?"
He'd had to ask that question, Noonan supposed, but it was a sign of weakness, just what the FBI agent had hoped for. The question made the answer easy.
"Your life, if you're lucky."
Chapter 38 Nature Resort. It was just too much for Will Gearing. Nobody had told him what to do in a case like this.
It had never occurred to him that security would be broken on the project.
His life was forfeit now. How could that have happened? He could cooperate or not. The contents of the canister would be examined anyway, probably at USAMRID at Fort Detrick, Maryland, and it would require only a few seconds for the medical experts there to see what he'd carried into the Olympic Stadium, and there was no explaining that away, was there? His life, his plans for the future, had been taken away from him, and his only choice was to cooperate and hope for the best. And so, as the C-17A Globemaster III transport climbed to its cruising altitude, he started talking. Noonan held a tape recorder in his hand and hoped that the engine noise that permeated the cargo area wouldn't wash it all away. It turned out that the hardest part for him was to keep a straight face. He'd heard about extreme environmental groups, the people who thought killing baby seals in Canada was right up there with Treblinka and Auschwitz. And he knew that the Bureau had looked at some for offenses like releasing laboratory animals from medical institutions, or spiking trees with nails so that no lumber company would dare to run trees from those areas through their sawmills. But he'd never heard of those groups doing anything more offensive than that. This, however, was such a crime as to redefine monstrous.
and the religious fervor that went along with it was entirely alien to him, and therefore hard to credit. He wanted to believe that the contents of the chlorine canister really was just chlorine, but he knew that it was not. That and the backpack were now sealed in a mil-spec plastic container strapped down in a seat next to Sergeant Mike Pierce.
"He hasn't called yet," John Breitling observed, checking his watch.
The closing ceremonies were underway. The head of the International Olympic Committee was about to give his speech, summoning the youth of the world to the next set of games. Then the assembled orchestra would play, and the Olympic flame would be extinguished, just as most of humanity would be extinguished. There was the same sort of sadness to it, but also the same inevitability. There would be no next Olympiad, and the youth of the world would not be alive to hear the summons.
"John, he's probably watching this the same as we are. Give him some time," Bill Henriksen advised.
"You say so." Breitling put his arm around his wife's shoulders and tried to relax. Even now, the people walking in the stadium were being sprinkled with the nanocapsules bearing Shiva. Bill was right. Nothing could have gone wrong. He could see it in his mind. The streets and highways empty, farms idle, airports shut down. The trees would thrive without lumberjacks to chop them down. The animals would nose about, wondering perhaps where all the noises and the two-legged creatures were. Rats and other carrion eaters would feast. Dogs and cats would return to their primal instincts and survive or not, as circumstances allowed. Herbivores and predators would be relieved of hunting pressure. Poison traps set out in the wild would continue to kill. But eventually these would run out of their poisons and stop killing game that farmers and others disliked. This year there would be no mass murder of baby harp seals for their lovely white coats. This year the world would be reborn. And even if that required an act of violence, it was worth the price for those who had the brains and aesthetic to appreciate it all. It was like a religion for Breitling and his people. Surely it had all the aspects of a religion. They worshipped the great collective life system called nature. They were fighting for her because they knew that she loved and nurtured them back. It was that simple. Nature was to them, if not a person, then a huge enveloping idea that made and supported the things they loved. They were hardly the first people to dedicate their lives to an idea, were they?
"How long to Hickam?"
"Another 10 hours, the crew chief told me," Pierce said, checking his watch. "This is like being back in the 8 Deuce. All I need's my chute, Tim," he told Noonan.
"Huh?"
82nd Airborne, Fort Bragg, my first outfit." "All the way, baby," Pierce explained for the benefit of this FBI puke. He missed jumping, but that was something special ops people didn't do. Going in by helicopter was better organized and definitely safer, but it didn't have the rush you got from leaping out of a transport aircraft along with your squad mates.
"What do you think of what this guy was trying to do?" Pierce asked, pointing at Gearing.
"Hard to believe it's real."
"Yeah, I know," Pierce agreed.
"I'd like to think nobody's that crazy. It's too big a thought for my brain, man."
"Yeah," Noonan replied, "mine too."
He felt the mini-tape recorder in his shirt pocket and wondered about the information it contained. Had he taken the confession legally? He'd given the mutt his rights, and Gearing said that he understood them. But any halfway competent attorney would try hard to have it all tossed, claiming that since they were aboard a military aircraft surrounded by armed men, the circumstances had been coercive. And maybe the judge would agree. He might also agree that the arrest had been illegal. But, Noonan thought, all of that was less important than the result. If Gearing had spoken the truth, this arrest might have saved millions of lives.
He went forward to the aircraft's radio compartment, got on the secure system, and called New York. Clark was asleep when his phone rang. He grabbed the receiver and grunted, "Yeah?" only to find that the security system was still handshaking. Then it announced that the line was secure.
"What is it, Ding?"
"It's Tim Noonan, John. I have a question."
"What's that?"
"What are you going to do when we get there? I have Gearing's confession on tape. The whole thing. Just like what you told Ding a few hours ago."
"Word for fucking word, John.
What do we do now?"
"I don't know yet."
"We probably have to talk to Director Murray, and also with Ed Foley at CIA. I'm not sure the law anticipates anything this big, and I'm not sure this is something we ever want to put in a public courtroom, you know?"
"Well, yeah," Noonan's voice agreed from half a world away.
"Okay, just so somebody's thinking about it."
"Okay, yeah, we're thinking about it."
"Anything else?"
"I guess not."
"Good, I'm going back to sleep." And the line went dead, and Noonan walked back to the cargo compartment. Chavez and Tomlinson were keeping an eye on Gearing, while the rest of the people tried to get some sleep in the crummy USAF seats, and thus pass the time on this most boring of flights. Except for the dreams Noonan discovered in an hour, they weren't boring at all.
"He still hasn't called," Breitling said, as the network coverage went through Olympic highlights.
"I know," Henriksen conceded. "Okay, let me make a call."
He rose from his seat, pulled a card from his wallet, and dialed a number on the back of it to a cellular phone owned by a senior global security employee down in Sydney.
"Tony, this is Bill Henriksen. I need you to do something for me right now, okay?"
"Good.
Find Will Gearing and tell him to call me immediately. He has the number."
"Yes, that's the one."
"Right now, Tony."
"Yeah, thanks."
And Henriksen hung up.
"That shouldn't take long. Not too many places he can be except maybe on the way to the airport for his flight up the coast."
"Relax, John," the security chief advised, still not feeling any chill on his skin. Gearing's cell phone could have a dead battery. He could be caught up in the crowds and unable to get a cab back to his hotel. Maybe there weren't any cabs. Any one of a number of innocent explanations.
Down in Sydney, Tony Johnson walked across the street to Will Gearing's hotel. He knew the room already, since they'd met there, and took the elevator to the right room. Defeating the lock was child's play. Just a matter of working a credit card into the door jamb and flipping the angled latch, and then he was inside. And so were Gearing's bags, sitting there by the sliding mirror doors of the closet. And there on the desk table was the folder with his flight tickets to the northeast coast of Australia, plus a map and some brochures about the Great Barrier Reef. This was odd. Will's flight, he checked the ticket folder, was due to go off in 20 minutes. And he ought to be all checked in and boarding the aircraft by now. But he hadn't left the hotel. This was very odd.
"Where are you, Will?" Johnson wondered.
Then he remembered why he was here, and lifted the phone.
"Yeah, Tony. So, where's our boy?" Henriksen asked confidently.
Then his face changed.
"What do you mean?
What else do you know?"
"Okay, if you find out anything else, call me here. Bye."
Henriksen set the phone down and turned to look at the other two.
"Will Gearing's disappeared. Not in his room, but his luggage and tickets are. Like he just fell off the planet."
"What's that mean?" Carol Breitling asked.
"I'm not sure. Hell, maybe he got hit by a car in the street.
Or maybe Popoff spilled his guts to the wrong people and they bagged him," John Breitling suggested nervously.
"Popoff didn't even know his name. Honeycutt couldn't have told him. He didn't know Gearing's name either."
But then Henriksen thought, oh, shit. Foster did know how the Shiva was supposed to be delivered, didn't he? Oh, shit.
What's the matter, Bill? John asked, seeing the man's face and knowing that something was wrong.
John, we may have a problem, the former FBI agent announced.
What problem? Carol asked.
Henriksen explained, and the mood in the room changed abruptly.
You mean they might know?
Henriksen nodded.
That is possible, yes.
My God, the presidential science advisor exclaimed. If they know that, then... Yeah, Bill nodded. Then we're fucked. What can we do about this? For starters, we destroy all the evidence. All the Shiva, all the vaccines, all the records. It's all on computers, so we just erase it. There shouldn't be much in the way of a paper trail, because we told people not to print anything up, and to destroy any paper notes they might make. We can do that from here. I can access all the company computers from my office and kill off all the records. They're encrypted, all of them, John Breitling pointed out. You want to bet against the codebreakers at Fort Meade? I don't, Henriksen told them. No, those files all have to go, John. Look, you beat a criminal prosecution by denying evidence to the prosecutors. Without physical evidence, they can't hurt you. What about witnesses? The most overrated thing in the world is an eyewitness. Any lawyer with half a brain can make fools out of them. No, when I was working cases for the Bureau, I wanted something I could hold in my hand, something you could pass over to the jury so they could see it and feel it. Eyewitness testimony is pretty useless in court, despite what you see on TV. Okay, I'm going to my office to get rid of the computer stuff. Henriksen left at once, leaving the two Breitlings behind him.
My God, John, Carol said in quiet alarm. What if people find out? Nobody'll understand.
Understand that we were going to kill them and their families?
No,
her husband agreed dryly. I don't think Joe Sixpack and Archie Bunker will understand that very well.
So what do we do?
We get the hell out of the country. We fly down to Brazil with everyone who knows what the project is all about. We still have access to money. I have dozens of covert accounts we can access electronically, and they probably can't make a criminal case against us if Bill can trash all the computer files. Okay, they may have Will Gearing under arrest, but he's just one voice, and I'm not sure they can come after us legally in a foreign country on the word of one person. There are only 50 or so people who really know what's happening. All of it, I mean. And we have enough airplanes to get us all to Manaus.
In his office, Henriksen lit up his personal computer and pulled open an encrypted file. It had telephone numbers and access codes to every computer in Horizon Corporation, plus the names of the files relating to the project. He accessed them via modem, looked for the files that had to go, and moved them with mouse clicks into trash cans that shredded the files completely, instead of merely removing their electronic address codes. He found that he was sweating as he did so, and it took him 39 minutes. But after that time was concluded, he was certain that he'd completely destroyed them all. He checked his list and his memory for the file names, and conducted another global search. But no, those files were completely gone now.
Good.
Okay, he asked himself. What else might they have?
They might have Gearing's Shiva delivery canister.
That would be hard to argue with, but what really did it mean?
It would mean, if the right people looked at it, that Gearing had been carrying a potential bio-war weapon. Gearing could tell a U.S. attorney that it had come from Horizon Corporation, but no one working on that segment of the project would ever admit to having done it. And so, no, there would be no corroborating evidence to back up the assertion. Okay, there were, by his count, 53 Horizon and Global Security employees who knew the project from beginning to end.
Work on the A and B vaccines could be explained away as medical research. The Shiva virus and the vaccine supplies would be burned in a matter of hours, leaving no physical evidence at all. This was enough. Well, it was almost enough. They still had Gearing, and Gearing, if he talked, and he would talk, Henriksen was sure, because the Bureau had ways of choking information out of people, could make life very uncomfortable for Breitling and a lot of other people, including himself. They would probably avoid conviction, but the embarrassment of a trial, and the things that the revelations might generate, casual comments made by project members to others, would be woven together. And there was Popoff, who could link John Breitling and himself to terrorist acts. But they could finger Popoff for murdering Foster Honeycutt, and that would pollute whatever case he might try to make. The best thing would be to be beyond their reach when they tried to assemble a case. That meant Brazil, and Project Alternate in the jungles west of Manaus. They could head down there, sheltered by Brazil's wonderfully protective extradition laws, and study the rainforest. Yes, that made sense. Okay, he thought. He had a list of the full project members, those who knew everything, those who, if the FBI got them and interrogated them, could hang them all. He printed this list of the true believers and tucked the pages in his shirt pocket. With the work done and the alternatives analyzed, Henriksen went back to Breitling's penthouse office. "I've told the flight crews to get the birds warmed up," Breitling told him when he came in. "Good," Henriksen nodded. "I think Brazil looks pretty good right now. If nothing else, we can get all of our critical personnel fully briefed on how to handle this, how to act if anyone asks them some questions. We can beat this one, John, but we have to be smart about it."
"What about the planet?" Carol Breitling asked sadly.
"Carol," Bill replied, "you take care of your own ass first. You can't save nature from inside Marion Federal Penitentiary. But if we play it smart, we can deny evidence to anyone who investigates us. And without that, we're safe, guys. Now," he pulled the list from his pocket, "these are the only people we have to protect. There's 53 of them, and you have 4 Gulf Streams sitting out there. We can fly us all down to Project Alternate. Any disagreement on that?" John Breitling shook his head. "No, I'm with you. Can this keep us in the clear legally?" Henriksen nodded emphatically. "I think so. Popoff will be a problem, but he's a murderer. I'm going to report the Honeycutt killing to the local cops before we fly off. That will compromise his value as a witness, make it look like he's just telling a tale to save his own ass from the gallows, whatever they use to execute murderers here in Kansas. I'll have McLean and Kilgore tape statements we can hand over to the local police. It may not be enough to convict him, but it will make him pretty uncomfortable. That's how you do this. Break up the other guy's chain of evidence and the credibility of his witnesses. In a year, maybe 18 months, we have our lawyers sit down and chat with the local U.S. attorney. And then we come home. Until then, we camp out in Brazil. And you can run the company from there via the Internet, can't you?"
"Well, it's not as good as what we planned, but..."
"Yes," Carol agreed, "but it beats the hell out of life in a federal prison."
"Get everything moving, Bill," John ordered. "So, what do we do with this?" Clark asked, on waking up. "Well," Tom Sullivan answered, "first we go to the assistant director in charge of the New York office, and then we talk to a United States attorney about building a criminal case."
"I don't think so," Clark responded, rubbing his eyes and reaching for the coffee.
"We can't just put the arm on them and whack 'em, you know. We're cops. We can't break the law," Chatham pointed out.
"This can never see the light of day in a court. Besides, who's to say that you'll win the case? How hard will this be to cover up?"
"I can't evaluate that. We have 2 missing girls they probably murdered.
More if our friend Popoff is right. And that's a crime, both federal and state. And Jesus, this other conspiracy. That's why we have laws, Mr. Clark.
Maybe so, but how fast do you see yourself driving out to this place in Kansas, whose location we don't know yet, with warrants to arrest one of the richest men in America?
It will take a little time, Sullivan admitted.
A couple of weeks at least, just to assemble the case information, Special Agent Chatham said. We'll need to talk with experts, to have that chlorine jar examined by the right people. And all the while the subjects will be working to destroy every bit of physical evidence. It won't be easy, but that's what we do in the Bureau, you know.
I suppose, Clark said dubiously. But there won't be much element of surprise here. They probably know we have this Gearing guy. From that, they know what he can tell us.
True, Sullivan conceded.
We might have to try something else.
What might that be?
I'm not sure, Clark admitted. The videotaping was done in the project's media center, where they'd hoped to produce nature tapes for those who survived the plague. The end of the project, as an operational entity, hit its members hard. Kirk McLean was especially downcast, but he acted his role well in explaining the morning rides that he, Saroff, Honeycutt, and Kilgore had enjoyed. Then Dr. John Kilgore told of how he'd found the horses, and then came McLean's explanation of how the body was found, and the autopsy Kilgore had personally performed, which had found the 44 bullet that had ended Foster Honeycutt's life. With that done, the men joined the others in the lobby of the residence building, and a minibus ferried them to the waiting aircraft. It would be a 3,500-mile flight to Manaus, they were told on boarding, about 8 hours, an easy hop for the Gulfstream V. The lead aircraft was nearly empty, just the doctors Breitling, Bill Henriksen, and Steve Berg, lead scientist for the Shiva part of the project. The aircraft lifted off at 9 in the morning, local time. Next stop, the Amazon Valley of central Brazil. It turned out that the FBI did know where the Kansas site was. A car and two agents from the local resident agency drove out in time to see the jets lift off, which they duly reported to their base station, and from there to Washington. Then they just parked at the side of the road, sipped at their drinks, ate their McDonald's burgers, and watched nothing happening at all at the misplaced buildings in the middle of wheat country. The C-17 switched crews at Hickam Air Force Base in Hawaii, then refueled and lifted off for Travis in Northern California. Chavez and his party never even departed the aircraft, but watched the new crew arrive with box lunches and drinks, and then settled in for the next 6 hours of air travel. Wilson Gearing was trying to explain himself now, talking about trees and birds and fish and stuff. Ding overheard. It was not an argument calculated to persuade the father of a newborn and the husband of a physician, but the man rambled on. Noonan listened politely and recorded this conversation, too. The flight south was quiet on all the aircraft. Those who hadn't heard about the developments in Sydney guessed that something was wrong, but they couldn't communicate with the lead aircraft without going through the flight crews, and they had not been briefed in on the project's objectives. Like so many of the employees of Horizon Corporation, they had simply been paid to do the jobs for which they were trained. They flew now on a southerly course to a destination just below the equator. It was a trip they'd made before, when Project Alternate had been built the previous year. It, too, had its own runway sufficient for the business jets, but only VFR daylight capable, since it lacked the navigation aids in Kansas. If anything went wrong, they would bingo to the Manaus City Airport, 98 miles to the east of their destination, which had full services including repairs. Project Alternate had spare parts, and every aircraft had a trained mechanic aboard. But they preferred to leave major repairs to others. In an hour, they were feet wet over the Gulf of Mexico, then turned east to fly through the international travel corridor over Cuba. The weather forecast was good all the way down to Venezuela, where they might have to dodge a few thunderheads, but nothing serious. The senior passengers in the lead aircraft figured that they were leaving the country about as fast as it could be done, disappearing off the face of the planet they'd hoped to save. "What's that?" Sullivan asked. Then he turned. "Four jets just left the Kansas location, and they headed off to the south." "Is there any way to track them?" Sullivan shrugged. "The Air Force, maybe." "How the hell do we do that?" Clark wondered aloud. Then he called Langley. "I can try, John, but getting the Air Force hopping this quick won't be easy." "Try, will you, Ed? Four Gulfstream-type business jets heading south from central Kansas, destination unknown." "Okay, I'll call the NMCC. That was not a difficult thing for the Director of Central Intelligence to do. The senior duty officer in the National Military Command Center was an Air Force two-star, recently rotated into a desk job after commanding the remaining U.S. Air Force fighter force in NATO. "So, what are we supposed to do, sir?" the general asked. "Four Gulfstream-type business jets took off from central Kansas about half an hour ago. We want them tracked." "With what?" "All our air defense fighters are on the Canadian border. Calling them down wouldn't work. They'd never catch up." "How about an AWACS?" Foley asked. "They belong to Air Combat Command at Langley. Ours, not yours. And, well, maybe one's up for counter-drug surveillance or maybe training. I can check." "Do that," Ed Foley said. "I'll hold." The two-star in blue went one better than that, calling the North American Aerospace Defense Command in Cheyenne Mountain, which had radar coverage over the entire country, and ordering them to identify the four Gs. That took less than a minute, and a computer command was sent to the Federal Aviation Administration to check the flight plans that had to be filed for international flights. NORAD also told the general that there were two E-3B AWACS aircraft aloft at the moment, one 300 miles south of New Orleans doing counter-drug operations, and the other just south of Eglin Air Force Base, conducting routine training with some fighters based there in an exercise against a Navy flight out of Pensacola Naval Air Station. With that information, he called Langley Air Force Base in the Virginia Tidewater, got operations, and told them about the DCI's request. "What's this for, sir?" the general asked Foley, once the phone lines were properly lashed up. "I can't tell you that, but it's important as hell." The general relayed that to Langley Operations, but did not relay the snarled response back to CIA. This one had to be kicked to the four-star who ran Air Combat Command, who conveniently was in his office rather than the F-16 that came with the job. The four-star grunted approval, figuring CIA wouldn't ask without good reason. "You can have it if you need it. How far will it be going?" "I don't know. How far can one of those Gulfstream jets go?" "Hell, sir, the new one, the G-5, can fly all the way to friggin' Japan. I may have to set up some tanker support." "Okay, please do what you have to do. Who do I call to keep track of the shadowing operation?" "NORAD." He gave the DCI the number to call. "Okay, thank you, General. The agency owes you one." "I will remember that, Director Foley," the U.S. Air Force Major General promised. "We're in luck," Clark heard. "The Air Force is chopping an AWACS to us." "We can follow them all the way to where they're going," Ed Foley said, exaggerating somewhat, since he didn't understand the AWACS would have to refuel on the way. The aircraft in question, a 10-year-old E-3B Sentry, got the word 15 minutes later.
The pilot relayed the information to the senior control officer aboard, a major, who in turn called NORAD for further information and got it